We're going to pick it up in verse number 41. Jehoshaphat, son of Asa, began to reign over Judah in the fourth year of Ahab, king of Israel. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Asa, Jehoshaphat was 35 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 25 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Azubah, the daughter of Shilhai. Okay? So what we have here in 1 Kings 22 is basically a summary. Verse 43, he walked in all the ways of Asa his father. He turned not aside from it, doing that which is right in the eyes of the Lord. Nevertheless, the high places were not taken away, for the people offered and burnt incense yet in the high places. Jehoshaphat made peace with the king of Israel. Now you read that and you go, oh, okay, the king of Israel. Who's the king of Israel here? Ahab. Okay? He made peace with Ahab. Verse 45, now the rest of the acts of Jehoshaphat and his might that he showed and how he warred, are they not written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Judah? So you think that's it. And then verses 46 through 49 still talk about Jehoshaphat. Okay, it's kind of jumbled up here a little bit. The remnant of the Sodomites, which remained in the days of his father Asa, he took out of the land. Then there was no king in Edom, a deputy was king. Verse 48, Jehoshaphat made ships of Tarshish to go to Ophir for gold, but they went not, for the ships were broken at Ezion-Geber. Then said Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, unto Jehoshaphat, let my servants go with thy servants in the ships, but Jehoshaphat would not. And verse 50, and Jehoshaphat slept with his fathers. It's a euphemistic way of saying he died. Okay? So here in 2 Kings chapter 21, you have just a brief summary of the events of Jehoshaphat's life. We see here that he was the son of Asa, the king of Judah. Now, on the scale, humanly speaking, we understand, as is written, there's none righteous, no, not one. But on the human scale, was Asa a good king, a godly king, or a bad king? Okay, Asa was a godly king. Okay, and so he was the son of Asa, which means he had a good example at home. He had a godly father who tried to teach him how to serve the Lord and so forth. And it says here in verse number 43, he walked in the ways of Asa his father. Okay, we see a little bit later on in 2 Chronicles 17, we will see that the description there is used that he walked in the ways of his father David. Now, obviously, that term father would be grandfather, great-grandfather, how many greats we need to put on it, you know, to get to the right layer of the family line. But he walked in the ways of David and Asa. So that was his lineage, his upbringing. Obviously, he's raised in a godly home. He had a good example. And now we also see, we've already talked about this when we talked about Ahab, but his son Jehoram married the daughter of Ahab. Her name was Athaliah. Okay, now we read the phrase here in verse 44 that he made peace with the king of Israel. Very often when two countries would make peace, the seal or the confirmation of that peace treaty would be a marriage between the two families. The child of one king would marry the child of the other king. And the idea was, as long as your child is in, you know, my household, my child's in your household, that's going to be a deterrent to any sort of attack or hostilities. Okay? So you have here, in summary, he made peace, but we see over in 2 Chronicles more explanation. His son married Athaliah. So her mother was Jezebel. And when we get later on down in the story, we find out that she was just like her mama. Okay? She's the one who killed all of her grandkids so she could reign for a period of time on the throne. Okay, now that's a spoiler alert, but that's okay because by the time we get to it in 6 weeks, you may or may not remember that. All right, so now let's talk about the reign of King Jehoshaphat. We're told here in 1 Kings 22, he reigned 25 years and he became king at age 35, which means he reigned until right around 60 years of age. Now, for more of the story, so to speak, turn with me, if you would, over to 2 Chronicles chapter 17. There's much more information in 2 Chronicles chapter 17, really through 17 through 20. In chapter 21, verse 1, we have the final statement that says Jehoshaphat died. Okay, but 17, 18, 19, and 20 in 2 Chronicles give us much more information about Jehoshaphat. Okay, 17 of 2 Chronicles, verse 1. Jehoshaphat, his son, reigned in his stead and strengthened himself against Israel, and he placed forces in all the fenced cities of Judah, and set garrisons in the land of Judah and the cities of Ephraim, which Asa his father had taken. And the Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he walked in the first ways of his father David, and sought not unto Baalim. Now that Baalim there, the im, is a plural ending. It's Baal with a plural ending. So he sought not under Baals, is how we might say it in English. Okay, or Baal was a generic term for God. Okay, so in other words, what he's saying is he didn't seek other gods. Now, Baal became a specific name of a specific god in this region, but here it's saying he didn't seek other gods, but he simply sought the Lord. Verse 4, he sought to the Lord God of his father and walked in his commandments and not after the doings of Israel. Therefore, the Lord established the kingdom in his hand, and all Judah brought to Jehoshaphat presents, and he had riches and honor in abundance. Okay, so we see here the general spiritual character of his reign in chapter 17. He sought God like David had. He was established by God. Verse number 6 says his heart was lifted up. Now, sometimes that's a bad phrase. You read that phrase, you go, uh-oh. This is actually a positive use of that phrase. His heart was lifted up in the ways of the Lord. Moreover, he took away the high places and groves out of Judah. So, the high places were used for what purpose, generally speaking? Yeah, the false worship, the worship of the other gods. The high places and the groves were associated with the idolatrous worship. So, he took away those places of false worship, or at least as much of it as he could. Also, in the third year of his reign, he sent his princes, even to Ben-Hail and to Obadiah and to Zechariah and to Nethaneel and to Micaiah, to teach in the cities of Judah. And with them he sent Levites, even Shemaiah and Nethaniah and Zebadiah and Azahel and Shemaramaoth and Jehonathan and Adonijah and Tobijah and, Tabadonijah. Levites. There we go. We should have just skipped to that part. He sent the Levites. Okay, for what purpose? Why did he send these men? And with them Elishama and Jehoram priests, and they taught in Judah and had the book of the law of the Lord with them and went about through all the cities of Judah and taught the people. Okay? So he took away the high places and he restored the teaching of the law of God. All right, now, the Levites did not have one place of inheritance in Israel. They were scattered. That was originally a judgment by God because Levi had offended way back in the life of Jacob, and you know he was told as a result that he was not going to have his own inheritance. However, the Levites were the ones when Moses came down off the mountain, Israel's worshiping the golden calf, and he says, who is on the Lord's side? The Levites are the ones that stood up. And so then as a result, God gave them a position of honor and chose Aaron, you know, of the tribe of Levi as his family to be the priests. But you see in the Levites a picture of what we're also told, commanded in the New Testament. The Levites were not in one grouped location, but rather they were to be spread out all over. Originally, when the land was divided, there were 48 cities, four from each tribe, that were given to the Levites. So they were scattered all over. The idea is the same as Jesus said in the New Testament, that we're to be the salt of the earth and that we're to be the light of the world. They were to be scattered abroad. They were to be that salt or that preserving influence. They were to be teaching the law of God to the people, and people would have a close by resource if they had questions. The priests were to be the judges of God's law and so forth. So now that's the way it was supposed to be. Just because that's how it was supposed to be, is that the way it always was? No. But if before we're too hard on them, you know, let's do a little self-evaluation. Do you always do everything you're supposed to do? Say no. I brush my teeth and then I eat my breakfast. Okay, you know, don't try that. I mean, brush your teeth, then drink orange juice. Ooh, no, not a good combination. I mean, that's not a sinful thing. That's just maybe not the wisest practice, right? But do you always do everything you know you ought to do? No, and Israel didn't either. The fact that we're told here in 2 Chronicles 17 that he got rid of the high places and that he sent out the priests and Levites to teach means that that had diminished. Now, obviously, under Solomon, it diminished. Under Rehoboam, it diminished more, okay? But he is trying his best to reestablish that. But here's another important application truth. Just because you used to be doesn't mean you still are in the realm of spirituality. Does that make sense? There's a whole bunch of people in good churches that are in the family of the Eustas. I used to teach Sunday school. You know, I used to help in the bus ministry. You know, I used to do this, I used to do that. But every generation had to be taught, and even those that had heard it before needed to be reminded. Okay? And so he sent the priests and the Levites to teach. So all of this is a comprehensive plan to encourage the worship of God. We're talking about Judah in the southern kingdom. You get rid of the high places, you get rid of the groves, you distribute the teachers of the law, and you reestablish all of those things, okay? So we're in 2 Chronicles 17, verse number 10. And the fear of the Lord fell upon all the kingdoms of the lands that were round about Judah, so that they made no war against Jehoshaphat. Also, some of the Philistines brought Jehoshaphat presents and tribute silver, and the Arabians brought him flocks, 7,700 rams, 7,700 he-goats. And Jehoshaphat waxed great exceedingly, and he built in Judah castles and cities of store. And he had much business in the cities of Judah, and the men of war, mighty men of valor, were in Jerusalem. And you get a genealogy there. But why did he have this peace? Okay, God blessed him with peace and prosperity because he had decided to follow God. Okay? Now, there are some, you know, name it and claim it, or my new favorite way to describe that now, blab it and grab it. But, you know, there was some that would say, well, if you serve God, he must do this for you and your life will look like this. That's not always true, okay? If that were true, then James 1 and the instruction on trials would be unnecessary, okay? But here we see God was pleased with Jehoshaphat and he blessed him with a prosperity and a time of peace. And he used it wisely. Same thing we see with Asa. In the end of Asa's life, he wavered just a little bit. But for the longest time in Asa's life, he wanted to seek God. He had torn down idols in high places, and God gave him a time of peace to accomplish what pleased the Lord. Okay, so Jehoshaphat is reigning in the south. Who is the king in the north at the same time? Ahab. Okay, somewhere along the line here, they decided to make a treaty. That's interesting to me because we're told here in verse number 2 of chapter 17, he placed forces in all the fenced cities of Judah and set garrisons all over the place. Okay, he basically set his defenses against Israel. So maybe it seemed like he was afraid that Ahab and Israel were going to invade. So that may have been the reasoning behind eventually then making that peace treaty and allowing their children to marry one another. But that is a that had happened prior to what we see in chapter 18. Now, 18 verse 1, Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance, and he joined affinity with Ahab. Now, you knew it couldn't all just go the way it should, right? Verse 2, and after certain years, he went down to Ahab to Samaria, and Ahab killed sheep and oxen. Now, how do we know that there was a big time gap here? Because this story here in 2 Chronicles 18 is the same one that we looked at in 1 Kings 21 and 22 last week, where Ahab and Jehoshaphat are going to go, and Ahab puts on a big feast, and then he says, hey, will you go fight with us? He says, sure, but let's inquire of the Lord. And all the false prophets come and tell King Ahab what he wants to hear. And the one of them went so far as to make iron horns and said, you're going to push the enemy with the horns of iron. In other words, you're going to be an irresistible force. Okay? So then Jehoshaphat is the one that said, well, isn't there a prophet of the Lord? Okay? And then that's where we get, well, there's one guy, his name's Micaiah, but I hate him because he has nothing good to say about me. Well, Ahab, Jezebel, Baal worship, it's no wonder he didn't have anything good to say about it. Okay? But this is that same story in 2 Chronicles chapter 18. What happened immediately after that incident with Micaiah where the king says, take him back to jail and leave him there until I come home in peace? And Micaiah says, if you come home in peace, God isn't speaking by me. What happened the next day on the battlefield? Who died? Ahab. So this story here in 2 Chronicles 18 is the last chapter of Ahab's life. Okay, it's at the very end. So there's a time gap here of other things that happened in between because we were told in 2 Kings that Jehoshaphat became king in the fourth year of Ahab. Okay, so this is, you know, whatever, 18 years or something down the line, 15 years. It's a good chunk of time later when this incident happened here in chapter 18. But I won't go over it in great detail because we did spend a fair amount of time going over that last week. But just for a very brief review, we focused last time on Ahab. Hey, all the prophets said, go ahead, you're going to win. And Jehoshaphat says, is there a godly king? Well, we can ask Micaiah. They even tried to convince Micaiah on the way there, hey, just tell the king what he wants to hear. Obviously, his tone of voice, something was different, because when he got there, he's like, yeah, do what you want. God will bless you. There was an obvious note of sarcasm and insincerity in what he had to say. And then he says, how many times do I have to tell you? Only tell me what's true in the name of the Lord. And he says, all right, fine. I saw Israel scattered as sheep having no shepherd. See, didn't I tell you you wouldn't say anything good about me? I mean, that's the way this went. Okay? But when that whole thing went down and Micaiah says, the other prophets now feel insulted because he's contradicted them. So the leader of the other prophets comes over, slaps him on the face and says, when did God leave me to talk to you? What do you mean to tell me I'm not speaking for God? Then he tells the story. I saw this scene in heaven and one of the angels is going to be a lying spirit to deceive Ahab. Okay? That was God's design to deceive Ahab so he would go to the battle. So that angel was not, you know, lying when God says, go tell him this message. Okay? But the message itself was false because, oh, you're going to be great. Well, really, it's you're going to your death. But anyway, you have that whole scenario. And then the next day when they go to the battle, Ahab says, hey, I'm going to put on camo. You put on your royal robes. That was Jehoshaphat. That's the one we're concentrating on now. It was Jehoshaphat who actually agreed to this. That's the part that still blows my mind. You know, Ahab dressed like a common soldier and just tried to blend in and not draw too much attention. And Jehoshaphat actually put on his royal robes. You know, that has always puzzled me. Why would you, in essence, draw a big target on your chest, right? We know from the story in Kings and then in Chronicles that the enemy, the king of Syria, had given specific instructions. I'm not concerned with any other menial soldiers. I'm not even concerned with the captains. I only want the king of Israel. He said, fight neither with great or small, only with the king of Israel. So they zero in on the one wearing the royal robes. The only explanation that I have, and again, this is not spelled out in Scripture. This is an educated guess, okay? And after you hear it, you may think it's not so educated. In that case, it's just a guess, all right? But my best conjecture is that he had heard the prophecy. Micaiah said, I saw Israel scattered as a sheep with no shepherd. He didn't say anything about Judah, okay? So maybe it's possible that he was like, okay, you know, he didn't say anything against me, so I guess I'll be okay, all right? I mean, I don't have any other information other than what we're given in Kings and Chronicles. That's my best guess. If it's not right, we'll find out together when we get to heaven, okay? But he put on his royal robes. He went into battle. And, of course, what happened? Let's skip down a little bit in chapter 18. Let's drop down to verse number 28. The king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead. Verse 29, he says, I'm going to disguise myself. You put on your royal robes. Verse 31, it came to pass when the captains of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat, they said, look, it's the king of Israel. Therefore, they compassed about him to fight. But Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Lord helped him. And God moved them to depart from him. Very important statement there. What did he cry out? I don't know. I know what I would have been hollering if I were in that position. I'm Jehoshaphat. I'm not Ahab. Look, you know, I have blue eyes. He has brown. You know, he has a better tan than me. I don't know what he's trying to say, okay? But whatever he's saying, he is hollering out to try to preserve his life. Now, let me ask you this. Why was Jehoshaphat in a position that he needed to try to preserve his life? Because he made a compromising decision. Okay, what was Ahab's overarching purpose in life, or what was his overarching religious affiliation? Baal worship. We're told about Ahab that none before him had been so motivated as he, and it says his wife Jezebel stirred him up. But they were the most devout and enthusiastic followers of Baal that had ever been in that region up to that time. What business did Jehoshaphat have going in partnership with them? Zero, nada, zilch, none. Exactly. Okay? So, why is he in this position where he's got to cry out and try to save his life? Because he's in a spot he never should have been in, and he's in that spot not as a result of God's providence necessarily. He's in a result of choices he'd made. Okay? Now, if you and I were in that position, there's a temptation to say, you made your choice, you live with it. Right? Now, there are times when that is a necessary function in training children. Sometimes, if you always protect them from the consequences of their choices, then they don't learn that, okay, choices have consequences. It matters what I do. Okay? But here, God protected Jehoshaphat. Now, when we get to chapter 19, we're going to see that God was not happy about this. God sent a man of God to rebuke him. But here, the only reason they departed from him was because God moved in on this situation. Now, put myself in Jehoshaphat's shoes for a minute. I would have to acknowledge, yeah, I probably got myself into a bad situation before because I made a dumb decision. I'm thankful that God didn't just say, well, you're on your own, buddy. Right? God's merciful. He's long-suffering. He is kind. And he protected him, and then he chastened him later on, which is the way that God deals with his children. But here, God protected him. Verse 33, a certain man drew a bow at a venture, and we talked about that last week, where some guy's just like, hey, I got an extra arrow. God guided that right to the joints in the armor, the joint of the harness, it says, of Ahab. He made it out of the host. He made it back to the city, and he died that evening. Okay, but on the Judah side of that equation, Jehoshaphat put his own life in danger. You know who else he endangered in this adventure? His army and his people in Judah. Why? Because he'd made a previous bad decision to make a peace treaty with Ahab and let the children marry as a sign of that. And so now these are the dominoes in the chain, so to speak, the continued effects of a previous decision. So he has made an affinity with Ahab, and then there was a gap of time. And then when he went to visit Ahab, that's when this whole scene happened. Hey, will you go fight with me? He's like, yeah, we'll go fight with you. But he not only endangered himself, he endangered those for whom he was responsible by his choices. There's a lot of important lessons for you and me in this scenario, that it's important for your family that you try to make godly decisions, right? It's important that if you mess up somewhere, that you acknowledge it and get back on the track where you need to be, okay? But here, there was at least a part of this that he was stuck with, right? Because marriage was intended by God to be a lifetime commitment, right? But now, he didn't necessarily have to follow through and go visit Ahab. He did. But, there were consequences as a result down the line. And we're going to see a little bit later on in the story that he did it again, where he went and helped the king of Israel. But chapter 19, verse 1, Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned to his house in peace to Jerusalem. Okay? We see here in chapter 19, verses 1 and 2, he was rebuked and chastened. Verse 2, Jehu, the son of Hanani the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? That's a rhetorical question. Okay, what was the understood, expected answer? No, of course not. But what's also implied in this statement? Well, Ahab doesn't love God. That's true. What else? What had Jehoshaphat done? He'd helped the ungodly and joined with those who didn't love the Lord. So, he asked it in the form of a question, but really this is an accusation, or we could even say a condemnation, a judgment, if you will. He said, shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? Obvious answer, no. Therefore, is wrath upon thee from before the Lord. Now, I didn't find in here exactly what that wrath entailed, either here or in 1 and 2 Kings. But in some way, he was chastened of God. Okay? So, did Jehoshaphat completely get away with this? No. But see, that's the counterbalance to the story. There's a temptation to say, oh, look, he went to the battle with Ahab, and even though he really shouldn't have, because he was overall a good fella, God preserved him, so in essence, he got away with it. It's okay if you don't do everything, you know, the way you're supposed to do it. I mean, there's a temptation to kind of take that line of thinking, which is why it's important to balance that out with verse 2 here, where God says, because you did this, there's wrath upon you from the Lord. There's chastening from God. Okay? He didn't get away with it. Even if we're not explicitly told what happened, we are told that God sent judgment. Now, this is the way God works with his children, and I'm so thankful. Verse 3, there's a balance. There's judgment with compassion and mercy. Nevertheless, there are good things found in thee, in that thou hast taken away the groves out of the land and hast prepared thine heart to seek God. So he said, look, God's going to spank you for this, but it doesn't mean that he hates you, that he's throwing you away, that you're done. I mean, there are good things that you've done, and the Lord is pleased with that. But in essence, what he's saying is you need to get back to this. No more helping Ahab. You know, you get back to the things that brought God's blessing and brought a time of peace to the land of Judah in seeking God and seeking the law of God and getting rid of the idolatry instead of helping the idolaters here. Okay, so then we have another account here in the rest of chapter 19 of how God's law is restored in the public life of Judah. Okay, verse number 5 says, he set judges in the land throughout all the fenced cities of Judah, city by city. He said, take heed what you do, for you judge not for man, but for the Lord who is with you in the judgment. Wherefore now let the fear of the Lord be upon you, take heed and do it, for there is no iniquity with the Lord our God, nor respect of persons, nor taking gifts. This is the exact opposite of what the false prophets did. This is the exact opposite of what the corrupt judges did. When we get down into the minor prophets, we see condemnation time and again that the judges allowed their eyes to be blinded with a bribe and with a gift. But he specifically said, look, you're going to do this for the Lord and not for man. No respect to persons, no taking bribes. You just judge according to the law of God. Verse 8, moreover in Jerusalem did Jehoshaphat set of the Levites and of the priests and of the chief of the fathers of Israel for the judgment of the Lord and for controversy. So he set up again the court system with the officers, the Levites and the priests being the primary officers there. Verse 9, he charged them saying, thus shall you do in the fear of the Lord, faithfully and with a perfect heart. That term perfect has the idea of complete, entire, or wholehearted. Okay, so the idea here of a perfect heart is that you have a complete desire to do right in the eyes of the Lord. Not that you'll never make a mistake, not that you're case might never get overturned on appeal, but your desire and your goal and your operation and your methodology is to please the Lord and to do what the Lord wants. Okay, so that's what you have here in chapter 19. Is I think this is kind of an expansion on what we saw earlier, where he set the Levites and priests in the land, and he's continuing to build on that. Now I think it's between chapter 19 and chapter 20 that we get a story that's recorded in Kings, but it's not recorded in Chronicles, all right? So you can stick a bookmark here, finger, whatever, and let's look back at 2 Kings chapter 3 for just a minute. 2 Kings chapter 3. The reason I think this is here, this is different here, is because in 2 Kings chapter 3, we read that Moab rebelled against Israel. In 2 Chronicles 20, we see that Moab rebelled against Judah. Different circumstances, you know, a little different description. Okay? But we get a story here in 2 Kings chapter 3. Jehoram, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel and Samaria in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and he reigned 12 years. Okay? He wrought evil in the sight of the Lord, not like his father and his mother, for he put away the image of Baal that his father has made. Nevertheless, he cleaved in the sins of Jeroboam. So, this is the next in line after Ahab. But all I want to point out right now while we're looking at Jehoshaphat is this. What was the connection between this Jehoram and, yes, This is where names in Kings and Chronicles get super frustrating, because there's about 6 or 7 different Jehorams, and sometimes you take out the E-H, and the same guy is referred to just as Joram instead of Jehoram, okay? And there was Jehorams in Israel, and there were Jehorams in Judah, okay? So but this is specifically the descendant of Ahab who followed him on the king. What was the family connection with him and Jehoshaphat? Okay, Jehoshaphat's daughter-in-law was the sister of Israel's king, right? Because Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab, married Jehoshaphat's son. Okay, so now Jehoshaphat's son has a wife who's kin to the king of Israel. You follow that? You say, can you draw that out for me in a picture? Okay, I'll try to do that for next week. But here's the point I'm making. In 2 Kings chapter 3, we have another instance of where Jehoshaphat went to battle with Israel when he shouldn't have. Why? Because you got a family connection. His daughter-in-law is kin to the king of Israel, and so now he still maybe feels kind of an obligation. There's still that connection. And this is one of those instances where a previous decision impacts future decisions at times. Okay? So we won't take the time this morning to develop that. I just want you to see that Jehoshaphat overall was a godly king. He did many things that pleased the Lord. God gave him a time of peace as a reward for that. In essence, we're told in different places in the Old Testament that God chastens. And there is, Isaiah says it this way, "There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked." Okay, but this time of peace and time of prosperity was a direct result of his choice to serve God and to try to get rid of the idolatry and those kind of things. But he was not perfect. He was not without sin. So what's the application for you and me? I don't have to be perfect. I just have to be okay. No, wrong. Wrong. It's our obligation to do right in the eyes of God to the very best of our ability. But you should take that and apply it to the other people. Why? Because if I'm going to look at, well, I'll use Brother Fox as an example here. If I'm going to look at Brother Fox and compare, his resume to mine, what is our natural tendency? Who gets the benefit of the doubt, me or the other person I'm scrutinizing? Our natural tendency is we give ourselves the benefit of the doubt and we're more harsh on others, right? So I am to take this and say, okay, just because I don't agree with something Brother Fox did, that doesn't mean he doesn't love the Lord. He's not trying to serve God. He's not, God isn't pleased with him. If we can learn from this instance with Jehoshaphat that, okay, he was trying to serve God. He was trying to do right. He did things that we would disagree with. He did some things that he got spanked for at times. But if we can learn to give other people the benefit of the doubt that they do love God, they do want to do right. They didn't do it exactly right, or maybe they did something that was kind of obviously wrong. But that doesn't mean that God won't continue to work with them. God won't continue to use them and grow them and bring them along. It'll help us tremendously in how we interact with people, how we disciple, how we try to encourage, and how we even interact as a church family. Okay? So we see with Jehoshaphat, yes, there were obvious errors. But overall, God says he was trying to do right. He was pleased with his general direction. And if we can learn from that, okay, I need to avoid his errors with my own family, my own decisions. But if I can give grace to my brother, in essence, isn't that what the New Testament says? Remove the beam before you go after the mote. If I can do that, then that's a tremendous application here for us, a takeaway from the life of Jehoshaphat. Now, we'll talk about his second time of helping Israel, Lord willing, next week. But may the Lord help us to see in the lives of these people our own strengths, weaknesses, good decisions, bad decisions, and bring them in line with that which pleases the Lord.